Hello and welcome to this week's Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's program. 150 years ago, gold was discovered in California, leading to one of the largest population movements in American history, the California Gold Rush. In a few moments, I'll be speaking with Malcolm Rohrbaugh about that movement. But first, looking back at this week, September 28th through October 4th in history, we note that on September 29th, 1988, the United States launched Discovery, the first manned space mission since the Challenger explosion. September 30th, 1846, marked the end of an era of dental barbarism when a dentist in Charlestown, Massachusetts, performed the first tooth extraction using anesthetics. On October 1st, 1908, Henry Ford unveiled the Model T. Charles Schulz's Peanuts comic strip appeared on October 2, 1950, and on October 4, 1957, the Soviet Union launched the first artificial space satellite, Sputnik. Turning to this week's history in the news, according to news reports, blacklisted writers who wrote film scripts under other names during the anti-communist period of the late 1940s and early 1950s are finally receiving their due. The writers were forced to work in secret when they were suspected of communist affiliations. A special panel of the Writers Guild of America completed its job of restoring their credits this past week, correcting the record for a final 21 films, including The Highwaymen, The Las Vegas Story, and All Night Long. And Sacagawea, the courageous Shoshone woman who helped guide and serve as an interpreter for the Lewis and Clark expedition of the early 1800s, will be depicted along with the symbol of liberty on the proposed new $1 U.S. coin. You are listening to Talking History. Well, this year marks the 150th anniversary of the discovery in 1848 of gold in California, setting off one of the largest and most romanticized population movements in United States history, the California Gold Rush. Here to discuss that movement with us is Malcolm Rohrbaugh, professor of history at the University of Iowa, and the author of Days of Gold, The California Gold Rush in the American Nation, published by the University of California Press. Malcolm Rohrbaugh's book has been hailed by critics as, and I'm quoting now, an important new social and cultural history of the California Gold Rush, as restoring the California Gold Rush to its rightful place in national, not just Western history, and as a pleasure to read. Welcome, Professor Rohrbaugh, and congratulations on the great reviews of your book.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
All right. Let's get started very briefly, if you would, by summarizing for our listeners exactly what happened in 1848 at Sutter's Mill.
Well, John Sutter was a Swiss immigrant who had been given a large land grant by the Mexican government, which he was proceeding to develop and exploit mainly through the livestock grazing industry. And in late 1847, Sutter employed a New Jersey artisan named James W. Marshall to build a sawmill on his property, the sawmill on the American River. And on January 24th, 1848, the work having progressed, Marshall ran water through the mill race of the sawmill. And when he came out, he discovered flakes of gold in the bottom of the mill race. He retrieved the flakes, returned to the cabin where he and his workers were lodging, and at least according to reports we have, uttered the statement, "Boys, I believe I've found a gold mine." And the California Gold Rush, in a sense, takes off from this point.
Now, did either Marshall or Sutter intend that the word would get out and that this rush would then occur?
No, as a matter of fact, Sutter was very anxious to keep the discovery secret while the mill was completed and other work was done on his property. And as Marshall was his employee, he thought that Marshall should comply with his wishes But word gradually leaked out, and within a couple of months, large numbers of people, not large numbers of non-Indians in California, were beginning to make their way to the foothills of the Sierra and beginning to mine for gold.
Another one of those well-kept secrets in history.
Exactly. The idea of leaks in history is present throughout.
Right. Another great book for you. California at that time wasn't U.S. territory, though, was it?
No, that's right. California was part of the Republic of Mexico. It had been fought over during the Mexican War between 1846 and 1848. And within a month of Marshall's discovery, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed. And this treaty ceded the large portions of the Southwest, present-day American Southwest, including California, to the United States.
But there's no connection between that cession and the discovery of gold?
No. It was just one of those accidents of history, and I must say an accident that Americans at the time thought was providential. That is to say, it clearly indicated that God was favoring the American nation, was favoring Americans over Mexicans, was favoring Protestants over Catholics, and was indicating his benevolence by making gold American rather than Mexican.
Interesting. Well, much has been written about the, I guess we could call them 48ers and 49ers before they became a football team. Could you briefly describe these individuals? Much has been, sort of, they've been romanticized a great deal in history. What were they actually like?
Well, the 49ers, as they like to call themselves after the Great Overland Migration of 1849, tended to be individuals from every rank, every place, every socioeconomic class. I think we could generalize a little bit about them to say that on the whole they were predominantly male, although not exclusively so. They were people who generally fell into a certain age cohort, that is to say they were young. And on the whole, I think we could say that they were not poor. That is to say, it demanded a real capital investment in order to get to California. $1,000 or more to go by sea, $400 or $500 to go overland. All this at a time when the average working man, whether working on the fields or in factories, made probably $1 a day. Thus, it was not, I would say, an immigration of people who were poor, but of people who could afford this, who were looking to better themselves in a dramatic kind of way.
Right. Well, so much for that myth. Okay, what about some of the exceptions to the rule? There were many Chinese involved in the gold rush. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Well, the gold rush almost immediately became an international movement. It began in the summer of 1848 with the immigration of Mexican peoples from Sonora. It continued in 1848 with Pacific Islanders from Hawaii who were called Kanakas. And almost at the same time, in late 1848, the Chileans and Peruvians. By 1849, we had Western Europeans, especially the French, the English and Irish, and the Germans. And in 1850, we have arriving the Australians and the Chinese. The Chinese become especially numerous after 1852. In the decade of the 1850s, California was probably the most cosmopolitan society in the world, and San Francisco was probably the most cosmopolitan city. It was an extraordinary movement of diverse peoples into this one place.
Yet you suggest in your book, and others have as well, that the Chinese were not particularly welcome.
Well, the Chinese were not welcome, but after 1851 or so, no foreign groups were welcomed.
Huh.
And foreign groups, beginning with the Mexicans in 1850 and the Peruvians and the Chileans were systematically expelled from the mines. One of the results of this was that the many groups, the Mexicans, the Chileans, the Peruvians, and later on the French, went home. The Chinese continued to come, and they continued to stay. And so by the middle of the 1850s and late 1850s, they had become the principal target of Americans who wished to take over the mines for themselves and who saw the Chinese as competition.
Interesting. Well, what about another group? What about women? How many were there, if any, and what role did they play in all of this?
I'm sorry, how many?
Women, how many, and what role did they play in the
Which group? Gold Rush?
Women?
Well, the Gold Rush initially was very male. Some of the mining counties, according to the census of 1850, had 97.5% men in them. That is to say, 25 women for every 1,000 in the population. And this changes very rapidly beginning in 1850, where we have the arrival of increasing numbers of women. The women are found, I would say, most often in cities and towns, but also they're found in the gold mining camps where they establish businesses, particularly boarding houses, baked goods, laundries, things of this nature, providing these services for the miners that are, for these bachelor miners, that are enormously profitable. There are many accounts of women who make more money doing laundry than their husbands make digging in the mines.
Interesting. Well, given that sort of demographic of those people that responded to the gold discovery, what was life like in these camps?
Well, I would say that, there were two very powerful characteristics in the mining camps, particularly in the early years. The first is that the miners formed themselves together in what they called small companies of 6 or 8 men who lived together, ate together, and who worked together. And these small groups may be thought of, I suppose, as the miners thought of them as a kind of extended families. That is to say, they replaced the families that they had left in the East. They were groups of people who owed an allegiance to one another. If one of them became sick, he was cared for. If one of them was unable to work, the others did the work for him. And, of course, in case worse came to worse, then this person died. Why, his companions presumably would notify his parents and make available to them whatever resources he had by way of estate. The second characteristic, which I've already alluded to, is that the mining camps in the first 3 years or so, at least, were predominantly male, with a very male culture. This means that you had a lot of male housekeeping and hygiene, or I suppose one could say lack of hygiene. The mining camps, I think, in many respects, continued to be very male-oriented in the first 10 years of the Gold Rush.
Well, sense of community, maybe, and male-oriented. Yeah, you write in your book that the Gold Rush affirmed many, or at least some, American values. What do you mean by that? Which values?
Well, the Gold Rush affirmed the idea that, first of all, that the bounties of the landscape that existed in the American nation belonged to its citizens. It was a concept that Americans had called since 1785 the public domain. There was a public domain. The public domain belonged to all citizens. It was to be exploited by all citizens. Now, the issue of the public domain was, of course, something of a gray area in California, which had only recently been acquired. But nonetheless, this was true, and it turned out that the gold belonged to the people who were there, who seized it. And the Americans turned out to be extraordinarily resourceful in their entrepreneurial capacity to exploit the gold mines to the fullest extent. European observers commented that the Americans were ideally suited to the California gold rush, and the reason they cited was that Americans were never discouraged. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, this supported the American value that people worked hard and energetically, and if you worked hard and energetically and you failed, then you just began to work someplace else. Hmm. And eventually things would work out for you.
Interesting. Were any American values called into question by the gold rush?
Well, the value that seems to have been most clearly called into the question was the idea that hard work and the kinds of values that Americans like to think were important at mid-century produced the best results. What seems to have happened is that the gold rush, almost everybody admitted, was a gigantic lottery. This kind of concept needs no introduction now, of course, because lotteries are all around us. But people went to the West and they discovered that the people who worked hardest and were the most sober and industrious were not necessarily those who found the most gold. And furthermore, the people who made the most money from the gold rush were frequently those who sold alcohol or those who were engaged in questionable entertainment businesses, those who were, in a sense, violating the moral precepts which were so important in the nation at the time. The gold rush, or at least part of it, tended to turn these upside down.
Interesting. Well, we're about out of time. Very briefly, whatever happened to John Sutter and James Marshall?
Well, as often happens in these occasions, neither of them really benefited. Sutter's kingdom was destroyed. And he spent the rest of his life in various lawsuits against the federal government trying to recover what I suppose we would call today damages. Mm-hmm. Marshall became something of a historic figure, going, I suppose we would say today, on the lecture circuit and being interviewed as the discoverer of gold. But he himself never realized anything from it either. Both of them died, I think we could say, more or less in obscurity.
Great story. Love it. Well, thank you, Professor Verbaugh, for being with us. I hope you'll join us again soon.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
You've been listening to Malcolm Verbaugh, author of Days of Gold, The California Gold Rush and the American Nation. This is Talking History. For this week's Radio Op-Ed piece, continuing our celebration of the 150th anniversary of the discovery of gold in California, we have invited J.S. Holliday to add his historical perspective. Mr. Holliday is the author of The World Rushed In, The California Gold Rush Experience, and Gold Fever, The Quest for California's Riches, just published by the University of California Press. Here, then, is J.S. Holliday.
In appraising and reevaluating the importance and the impact of the California Gold Rush years, it seems to me we should develop an appreciation of how gold production and the state's booming economy created a new optimism, not only in California, but like a contagion across America, a new sense that California and the West offered not a living, but the opportunity to make a fortune. There'd never been anything like that before. Consider that in 1849, from 1849 through 59, that decade, gold production came to $594 million, translating into today's money, that's $1.2 billion. in the 60s and the 70s, those two decades. Gold production, including mining in Nevada in the Comstock, the silver from there came to 837 million. All of that wealth pouring into a population in 1870 of only 560,000 people in all of California. And by the way, 40% of that population was foreign born. So we had a unique situation here. Wealth, and another quality that was unusual, this is a society that is almost entirely masculine. 90% of the population in the 1850s were men. Even in the 1870s and 80s, 70% were men. So here was a place where there were no families, no hometown eyes, no rules and constraints and inhibitions. There was a freedom, an opportunity to do whatever you felt like and to fail on one day and succeed the next. The excitement, one man wrote to his home, to his family, the excitement and the liberality here make one feel sad at the prospect of returning to the old beaten path at home. So California was a place that people were reluctant to leave. So many opportunities in agriculture. You could grow in fruit and in vegetables and in wheat. Tremendous wealth made by selling to these big urban markets, San Francisco, Sacramento, Marysville, Sonora, to the hundreds of mining camps. You could start your own bridge, toll bridge, and toll roads, hotels, billiard parlors, laundries, lumber, many ways of making money, rapid growth, a whole freedom of opportunity, free spending. Sam Clemens, who came here in 1864, later famous as Mark Twain, maybe put it all together beautifully. He said, it was a driving, vigorous, restless population, a place of astounding enterprises rushed through with magnificent dash and daring and recklessness of consequence. That was the image of California that impressed itself upon the national consciousness. And it seems to me that kind of freedom and opportunity remains as the image of California today.
You've been listening to J.S. Holliday, author of Gold Fever, The Quest for California's Riches. We've chosen for our site of the week and coming attraction, still other items related to the California Gold Rush, Sutter's Mill, California, where it all began, and the museum exhibit, The Gold Rush Revisited. Here to describe both is Talking History's producer, Cindy Workman. Cindy?
Sutter's Mill, where gold was first discovered, is now a state historic park in Coloma, California, about 45 miles northeast of Sacramento. At the site, you will find a replica of Sutter's original mill and the cabin of James Marshall, the man who first spotted the gold, a church, and a graveyard. The mill is a faithful replica of the original Sutter's mill, built with the aid of Marshall's own drawings, and an early photo is referenced. There is a visitor center and a museum also. And incidentally, the original gold nugget from Sutter's mill still exists. It is part of the permanent collection at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. Also, one of the largest and most important exhibits ever on the Gold Rush is at the Autry Museum of Western Heritage in Los Angeles until January 24th. The exhibit, called Gold Fever, offers paintings and old photographs, gold nuggets, and other artifacts from that time period. The exhibit will open at the Sacramento Memorial Auditorium in July of 1999. Brian?
Thanks, Cindy. And that's about it for another week of Talking History and our program on the California Gold Rush. I hope you've enjoyed our show. Join us next week for our discussion of the historical basis for the character Robin Hood. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next week, from Creighton University, this is Brian Laveau.